everybody. Welcome to the Talking Disney Classics podcast, the podcast where we talk about the Disney canon. And each month, the random number generator gives us a new film that we get to talk about in the world of Disney. And I'm film critic Rachel Wagner. And today we have a very special guest to talk about Sword in the Stone. And I'm really excited about it. But first, Stanford is here.
Hello.
Yes. And we have Dave Lee from Dave Lee Down Under here with us. And Dave, thank you so much for coming and talking about this fun bronze, I think it's bronze era. Anyway, this fun Disney classic with us.
Yes. No problem. Thank you, Dave.
No problem. Happy to be here. Really excited to get into this.
Yes. All right. So why don't you, for people that are new to you and your channel, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us kind of how you got sort of into Disney and watching Disney classics?
Sure. So I'm Dave. I run the YouTube channel, Dave Lee Down Under. Started 3 or 4 years ago now. It's essentially my way of sharing my love of film and pop culture with the world. And I have a specific interest in animated films, and even more specifically, the works of Walt Disney and the Walt Disney Company, sort of all eras of it. So I do a lot of videos based on animation, character histories, film histories, a lot of like rankings of the Disney eras that I've been doing, which have sort of taken off recently, which has been awesome. So all kinds of animation videos, and predominantly a lot of Disney stuff. My love of Disney, I guess, like most people, goes back to childhood. You know, so the earliest films you remember watching as a kid are Disney films. So I'm a 90s kid, so the very first film I ever remember seeing in cinemas was The Lion King. But I remember growing up with all the old VHS tapes of Snow White and Cinderella and all those classics, and of course Sword in the Stone, which is what we're here to talk about today. My huge interest in Disney really came probably when I was around 17, 18 years old, where something drew me to the Disney films, that where I realized just how incredible they were from an artistic standpoint, not so much just someone who's just a fan of the movies. And I was really sort of, I guess, implored to dive deep into the history of not only the films, but of the company and of Walt Disney and all these people who have been connected with the making of the films over the years. So I've spent probably the best part of the last 11 years or so really just in-depth studying the history of the studio and the people who've worked there and stuff. I've just developed this really, really deep love for the studio and the people, and particularly Walt Disney and his era and the Renaissance era as well. They're my two kind of favorites. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. What we've done on this channel is, or on this podcast is, instead of going through sort of chronological, we've had it be random every
random
month.
Number generator.
Dot at the wall.
Exactly.
And the funny thing is that it hasn't ended up being all that random. Like, I feel like we end up talking about 3 or 4 package films all at once. We end up talking about.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, that's the whole point of all of this.
Well, I look back over your list of films, and I actually, when I first looked at it, I thought, oh, they're going chronologically, because you had done like a series of films sort of in a row. But yeah, there you go. That's how it works out. When with my ranking videos, actually, I've been doing them out of order. So I started with doing the revival era, and then just sort of worked my way through all the eras when I felt it was kind of relevant to put a video out.
Yeah.
So it's been a little bit of a, you know, throw of a dart for me as well in that respect.
Yeah. Well, where I first discovered your videos was your Toy Story ranking. And the thing I admired about it, I had never seen anyone else do, is you ranked all of the specials included in with the main movies, which I thought was really smart.
Yeah. Well, no half measures, I think, just go all out. And I thought if I was going to do that, that's an example of doing one of these videos when it becomes relevant. Obviously, Toy Story 4 came out and I wanted to do it on the back of that. And I kind of thought, well, I can't just rank 4 movies. You know, how do I pad that out? And I thought, you know what, stuff it. I'm going to go back. I'm going to watch all the shorts, all the specials and stuff, and just rank them all together. And that was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, it was really good. I really enjoyed it.
Appreciate it.
So, all right. Well, we are going to dive into The Sword and the Stone. And this is a film that came out in 1963. And so this film is the 18th film from Walt Disney Animated Studios. Stanford, was this a film that you watched a lot growing up? Was it a favorite of yours? Or
It wasn't a film I watched a lot, but I loved, I had a storybook. It was probably like a little golden book or something of that sort of the Disney telling of The Sword and the Stone. And I just always loved the character design. I think I was particularly smitten with Merlin. I just, there's something about that blue smock, you know, and that pointed hat that he wears. And I loved his, you know, just that long beard, and just everything about Merlin always kind of transfixed me. And so I remember it more visually than I do as like a film, if that makes sense, as far as my childhood.
Yeah. What about you, Dave? Is this one that you watched growing up?
I feel like I'm sort of the same in that respect. I definitely remember having the VHS of it and watching it as a kid, but it's not one that I went back to a lot. I remember watching Snow White, Pinocchio, Bambi over and over again, Beauty and the Beast. Sword and the Stone is one that I feel like just never went back to that much. But again, as Stanford said, it's that idea of the visuals and the iconography of it that stick in your mind throughout the years. And I remember going back to it for the first time in years, probably 6 or 7 years ago, and just not remembering much about the film at all. Yes. You remember certain little bits and pieces, you know, the musical numbers, that fantastic animated segment at the end, the wizard duel, and just these little bits and pieces that you remember. But yeah, it's not one that really stuck with me all the way to the end. It's not one that I've, you know, had a deep-seated love for.
Yeah, it's the same with me. It is. I mean, I'm sure I saw it because I saw all the Disney films growing up, but it's not one that I remember. I don't have any nostalgia for it. So when I first reviewed the Disney canon, I was not into it at all. I didn't like it at all. and then I have to say, I feel like it's one that I am less hard on with each time I watch it. And I think I was in a particularly good mood this time around because I was just like, this is cute. This is fun. Yeah. Well, why was I such a grump before?
Well, you know, you do bring up a good point because, I mean, I think it really is cute. But also, you know, with this particular rewatch, it was no wonder this doesn't really resonate with me as a child, because I think the story's a bit muddled, and I know we'll probably get into some more of those details. But I mean, I guess I was giving myself a break as a kid, you know, for not just really being drawn to the story, but of course, just really enjoying the iconography, as Dave said.
Well, and I think it's also just something about being in quarantine and watching a Disney movie. I feel like I guess I was pretty hard on the Rescuers is not my favorite, Dave. I don't like Rescuers.
I'm the same. I'm not a huge
fan. Oh, I'm nodding that out here. okay. Thanks for still talking to me.
I did see the podcast you did on that, actually.
Yeah. Oh, did you?
Okay. I did not.
Our knockdown drag out. Yeah.
I think I was just in the mood to watch Disney because I was quarantined, isolated, and I don't know. It's just been such a weird, nutty time that the last thing I need to be hard on is perfectly harmless.
Exactly.
You know, Disney animated classic.
Yes. Well said.
But I guess in some of the backstory of this movie, they were originally, Bill Pete and Ken Anderson were originally going to be making a movie about Chanticleer.
Yes.
About the rooster.
Yes.
And that, I guess, did not go over well. It was rejected. So. No. And so then Ollie Johnston, he is quoted as saying that Call got furious with Bill for not pushing Chanticleer after the work he had put in on it. He said, "I can draw a darn fine rooster, you know," Bill said, "so can I." And Bill said, "so can I." And then Rupi called how humiliated they were to accept defeat and give in to the sword and the stone. So it started on kind of rocky, a little bit of a rocky ground. And I feel like that's the case with a lot of the Wolfgang Reitherman films of his sort of canon. I think a lot of them kind of, I don't know, he did a lot of those ones in sort of the Bronze era. And they all kind of have a bit of a rocky road.
Well, you gotta consider that this comes at a very, very strange time in Disney history, where Walt Disney is completely uninterested in making animated films, like almost completely separated from the animation division. This is the early 1960s. He's opened Disneyland 5 years earlier. He's got his television series. He's making live action films. He's in the process of making Mary Poppins. He's preparing pavilions for the World's Fair, which is coming up, 1963-64. He's just come off the back of spending 8 years making Sleeping Beauty, right, which is a movie that just completely went over budget. And when it opened at the, like, this was Walt Disney's magnum opus. Like, this was the film that was, you know, and then it opens, it just completely bombs, mostly because of how over budget the film went.
Yeah, people don't realize it's one of the biggest box office failures ever, in the history of Hollywood. Yeah.
Insane. So that was such a blow to him. I mean, and he was, I guess, even mid-50s is when he starts drifting away from the animation division because he's got all these other things going on. But Sleeping Beauty coming out was that final nail in the coffin where he was like, he didn't have the time for it and he just lost the passion for it. So the two films that came out following Sleeping Beauty, 101 Dalmatians and Sword in the Stone, were essentially made as smaller, less epic, less grand films that the films could make on a budget and not have to put too much time and effort into making. So a lot of these films ended up getting, you know, passed off to the Woolly Rythermans and Milk Carls and all them. So it is a very, very rocky, very strange time in the studio. And that's, I think, when you look at the Dark Age films, and you sort of see the struggle in the studio of trying to figure out how to make a film without Walt Disney, you know, after his passing, where you've kind of got the seeds of that kind of coming into this era prior to him passing, because he wasn't around and people were struggling to figure out how to make these films. And they wanted to make these big, grand, epic films like the Rooster one, Chanticleer. And they just weren't able to do it. So there's a lot of tension and it's a crazy time at the studio. And that's why, you know, you see films like this are just not to that same scale.
Yeah. When we talked about 101 Dalmatians, we talked about the drag 'em out fights that basically Walt and the animators that were in charge of that they had with him over, that it wasn't until just before he died that they forgave him for what he did. And there was some reconciliation between them. Yeah. So it was definitely a very intense time. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's also when we started with this Xerox animation and they started definitely doing some shortcuts as well, where they were repeating animation and they're doing some other things like that. And the thing I've always felt like with Sword in the Stone is I just feel like it's such a missed opportunity. Because we probably will never get our true Arthurian legend story from Disney. And how great would that be to have?
I agree with you, Rach, because, again, rewatching it this time, too, I felt a lot of regret just thinking, oh, darn. Yeah. I wouldn't it have been cool if they had really been able to go all out rather than make it more of the kind of the light film that this is? Yeah. Go something that was really interesting about King Arthur, you know.
Yeah, but to have maybe it's just too dark to do the, you know, Camelot story for a Disney film, but you know, the best we're gonna get is the Quest for Camelot, which is not even Disney, but terrible film. But yeah, so the movie, it starts out with, I think actually one of the stronger parts of the film, with you get your classic Disney book And you get this beautiful Sword and Stone song sung by Fred Darien. And I love that.
I think
it's such a strong opening.
Yeah, I do too. I love the book, you know, when they use the storybook and the illuminated manuscript style of art that they are using is it's lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. Did that sound out to you, Dave?
Oh yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah. I mean, I love I think Sleeping Beauty has some of the most gorgeous animation.
Absolutely.
I feel like they were really just trying to just keep pulling threads from that angular design, which is so different to anything that came before, you know, Sleeping Beauty and this kind of era of films. I just really love that angular style. And even in that opening sequence, you can really see that kind of medieval like French inspired arch. I think it's gorgeous. The opening sequence especially is just, yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And it just has a beautiful tenor sound, I think, that singer.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
Really nice. So then we get the rest. I mean, I think all the songs actually are by the Sherman Brothers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then we get Sebastian Cabot as our narrator. And he has a great voice perfect for a narrator. And then we start out, I kind of like the fact that Arthur notices that Archimedes talks. Because that was one of the things I said in The Rescuers. They're like, why isn't Penny surprised that the mouse are talking to her? Like, I would be taken aback a little.
Yeah.
She's chatting with the cat, too. You know? Here,
the owl is talking. Okay.
Yeah.
And the theme of the movie is that Arthur needs to get an education. And that's what Merlin... is wanting him to do. And the only thing that I kind of quibble with this, obviously education is good, but I feel like Merlin's definition of education is pretty narrow. You know, but he says that he wants to become a squire. He is really repulsed later on by that idea. And so the idea of doing anything kind of with his hands or doing anything kind of that's not sort of, I think, a book, education from a book or that kind of more classic type of education is like repulsive to Merlin. And I want to say, what's wrong with being a squire? That's like, why can't he do that? Why does he have to have some kind of scholarly education? I don't know. What do you think, Stanford?
You know, you bring up a very good point, and I don't understand it either. And I wonder, I'm not familiar with the source material. I mean, I think, of course, we're all familiar with just the general Arthurian legend, mm-hmm. but I haven't read any of these books from T.H. White, of which, you know, this is drawn from. I wondered if some of that was a point in the book and they kept it in the story. Again, I don't know. I sure don't like the education that Merlin is giving. We'll get into that.
But yeah.
The whole fish and squirrel segments, you know, not my favorites. Anyway, I know he was trying to teach him physics and, you know, gravity and different things like that, but still.
Yeah, because you go to these different segments and you think, well, how does this help him be a king at all?
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's just like, shouldn't he be learning some other things, maybe some history, maybe some, you know.
Well, and also, he doesn't actually, I don't think, learn anything. We'll talk about that later. But
yeah.
But like in the under the water segment, it's Archimedes that saves everybody. And in the squirrel, he just leaves. What does he learn? He doesn't learn anything from that.
And he breaks the poor little lady squirrel's heart, you know?
Yeah. And then with Madam Mim, that's all Merlin. So he doesn't learn any. Like, I don't understand why he is more capable of pulling the sword from the stone at the end of the movie than at the beginning of the movie. So what was the point of all those lessons?
I'm confused by the two. And then, you know, how Merlin and Archimedes are arguing about the education as well. And yeah, I don't get it.
What do you think, Dave, about this theme of education?
I I think the same. I think it's a product of people just trying to shove too many gags into the film. And that's what I feel like it's just one big vestibule for gag work. And without Walt there to rein everyone in and, you know, focus on the story, it's just, oh, let's just do as many gag pieces as we can. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's one of the things that I feel like is why I'm probably not so drawn to the film, is that focus on story is just not there.
Yeah.
And you look at these films, like the films that Walt Disney just so meticulously crafted, and they're so incredible because of that focus on story and that focus of grounding in reality and just really workshopping through everything. I mean, he was the mastermind of just, you know, that doesn't work, you know. And without him there, the whole narrative just falls apart, and it just becomes a bunch of gags after another. I kind of feel like maybe they weren't thinking about it. It was just not something that crossed someone's mind, and they went, oh, what kind of funny little gag pieces can we do? I'm not familiar with the source material myself. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And I don't know if it was just also something maybe from the 1960s that was sort of, maybe that was more of what we saw on television or what, if they were trying to sort of mimic, your Hanna-Barbera and your, some of the other companies doing animation. I don't know, but it just doesn't feel all that satisfying. Like, sure, it's cute and charming and whatever, but I think we hold these Disney animated classics to a higher level than that.
We
expect more than just, you know, Tom and Jerry being silly kind of thing.
I feel like there's also just this weird thing that's going on at the studio during this period where all the films just feel so episodic. So if you look at Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, these films just feel like it's not like a proper narrative. It's almost like there's just like little short segments one after another.
It's true.
And I don't know if that's a remnant from the package era where they were just so used to just stitching stuff together, or whether maybe that is just a narrative thing people were drawn to in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Well, when television. Yeah, exactly right. Or the like the Hanna-Barbera shows and stuff. It's like their programs were 3 or 4 7-minute animation stuck together.
This is a pretty sloppy movie as far as the animation is concerned. Especially compared to 101 Dalmatians, which is I think way more artistically consistent. And here you have things like, there's a scene where he starts a wizard blizzard, and in that scene you have Kay in this exact same animation eating a turkey leg 4 times. It's the exact same. There's lots of stuff like that in this that it just feels kind of sloppy. Mm-hmm.
I agree, because you look at something that's so meticulous and perfect as Sleeping Beauty, and then you look at this. Yeah. And again, I just feel like it was a cost savings move. At least that's how I try to process it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then some of it's really beautiful and some of it's not. And I just, inconsistent.
Well, the whole idea, of the whole xerography, Xerox process and reusing animation stuff is exactly that. Cost saving. Mm-hmm. Coming off the back of Sleeping Beauty, Roy Disney, who was the money man at the studio, went, okay, where can we cut corners? It was literally cost cutting measures, which is like, we've just blown so much money on this. How do we make these films smaller, more compact, and cheaper to make? The whole idea behind the Xerox process, I guess for anyone who's listening doesn't quite know what the Xerox thing is, prior to 101 Dalmatians, all the films, the animators' drawings were transferred onto cells with ink and paint by hand. Coming up 101 Dalmatians, they found, here's this cost-cutting measure where we can essentially print the artwork onto cells. And this means less man hours, that means less money. So straight off the bat, you've got this huge cost-cutting measure, which I personally think, I know I get a lot of people get annoyed with me for saying this, but I don't really like the look of the Xerox animation, which we've got here in Sword in the Stone. And on the back of that was also, all right, well, which old styles of animation do we have lying around that we can essentially retrace?
Different characters. Yeah.
And that's what it is. That's exactly what it is. It's cost-cutting measures to make these films as small as possible. And 101 Dalmatians was made on such a small budget, it made a lot of money back at the box office. And that was considered like a huge success because it made so much money. But it wasn't really made on a big budget to begin with. And right. Sword and Stone is definitely the same.
But the thing about 101 Dalmatians is that it's the only one that really works aesthetically with the Xerox method because it's got black and white spot characters as your lead characters.
Yeah.
And so it works. And this, I feel like everything looks really gray and really murky and dark. And it's just not all that pleasant as far as the backgrounds, as far as your world building. And I feel like, especially if you're going to try to pull off this kind of gag type thing, I feel like it needs to be cuter. Yeah. It needs to be a little brighter, punchier.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that like Robin Hood with its flaws, it's way funnier in my opinion than this.
Oh yeah,
for sure.
Funnier. Mm-hmm. More entertaining, I think, overall. And yeah.
I mean, especially because you got Peter Ustinov crushing it.
The voice talent, they're all aces in that, you know.
Yeah. Anyway, so we start out with their education, and he has to finish doing the dishes, and so they set a spell for Higgitus Figgitus. And that's probably the best part of the movie. Would you agree?
I'd agree.
Well, that scene, and I personally love the Wizard's Duel. I know we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But even though it's, what does that have to do with the story? Who knows? But that Higgins thing, that's the scene that I also remember as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that I wish, like, wow, that's the place I'd like to see. Like, I wish there were Disneyland ride or something there where you go through that, just that scene and maybe the Wizard's Duel and then call it good. I don't care about, going underwater or, being a squirrel, it's just all those flying books and everything, it's Disney magic. I think.
So our character, Wart, and he is one of the only Disney characters that is actually a child. Like almost all Disney movies are about young adults. and there are a few. You've got your Lilo and Stitches. You have, Mowgli.
Mowgli.
And then you obviously have younger animals, too. But there are a few, but he is a child character, which I do kind of like. Meet the Robinsons is another one. But anyway, and he is voiced by Ricky Sorensen. And did we notice that his voice changed?
Well, I paid closer attention because I looked at the cast list before this screening, before I watched it, and it's two of Wooly Rhythm and Sons, right? Who to take over. Is that what you saw too?
Yep. Richard Reitherman and Robert Reitherman.
Yeah.
He went with the double R's twice.
Yeah.
So yeah. And so that's interesting.
It is. Yeah, I guess he hit puberty. The original actor, they needed more stuff.
Yeah, I guess that's the downside to having children and as opposed to adolescents and young adults.
Yeah. and one other thing about this too, I like as we discussed, we love the setup. That opening song, and it sets up so well just the legend of the Sword in the Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like we get enough information about Wart. I just feel like Wart just shows up, and we know that he's subservient to to Kay and whatnot. And he's an orphan, right? But and maybe there's not a lot to say, but I just kind of wish that. The only reason that we're supposed to sympathize with Wart is because he's there, but we don't really. I just wish we learned a little bit more about him. Maybe there's not more to say, but I kind of wish there were.
Well, yeah, when you compare him to a character like Ariel, for instance, where we learn so much about her and her dreams and what she wants. And
in that like opening few minutes of the film, we learn a lot.
Or Belle.
Yeah. And we know nothing about Wart other than, you know.
And he's perfectly happy being a squire. Like, he has no sort of grand, there's no I want moment at all.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we kind of get that from Merlin, who has the vision that someone is going to be dropping in. Mm-hmm. With great potential. So, I guess we have to learn that from Merlin, but still. Anyway, mm-hmm. It's just one of my gripes, narrative gripes, of which there are many.
I agree. Yeah. So we find out that there's going to be a big tournament on New Year's Day, and the winner becomes the king. And so that's pretty exciting. So they start training Kay, and he's going to compete. And then Merlin starts doing his lessons with Wart. And the first lesson is to turn him into a fish. And the idea is that you are to use your brain, not your instinct. And I kind of wonder, like, don't we need both to be king? Don't we need our instinct and our brain?
Yeah, I just tell you, these lessons just drive me crazy.
Well, and like I said, even if that's the lesson that's supposed to be learned is to use your brain, he doesn't actually learn it because Archimedes has to save him in the end.
Yeah.
And then he just goes off.
I don't feel like he learns anything, and I really like what Dave said. I think it's really just a whole bunch of gags.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, they're down there singing and swimming around and just there's no substance.
But nothing happens, you know? I mean, nothing's really of any substance for the story development or for character development. And, and you know, in every one of these, even in the very opening sequence with Wart and Kay, you know, Wart's getting chased by that wolf who's trying to eat him. And I know that's kind of a gag thing, but it's this running thing where, as an animal, you know, Wart gets thrown into this animal kingdom thing where it's, you know, circle of life, right? I mean, these animals are trying to eat him. They're trying
to kill
him. I
hate that wolf, by the way. It looks terrible. I hate the wolf.
But I don't understand, like, I mean, because again, is Wart supposed to learn something from these animals trying to kill him? Or, I mean, I don't know. It just feels like it's unnecessary. It's, again, gags, but without substance.
He's evidently supposed to, I don't know. That's what Merlin says, use your brain, not your instinct.
Yeah.
So I guess that's what he's trying to teach him. And then he sings, that's what makes the world go round, is there. And that's a fun Sherman Brothers song. Was this it's one of the last they did. But then we had the Aristocats.
Yeah.
Some others.
Well, this is Mary Poppins, the year after.
Right. Yeah. So,
well, this was the first animated one they did.
Okay, so, I knew it was important. I can remember.
Yeah.
So that one makes the world go round, sung by Merlin and Wart. Then we have a little bit of a Higgidus Figgidus reprise. And he says, who cares as long as the work gets done? And I think that's actually a really terrible lesson to teach somebody who's becoming a king. Right?
I know. Who created these lesson plans? They are so...
I mean, who cares? As long as if the servants do it, if the whatever do it, as long as it gets done, who cares?
Yeah.
So I don't know about Merlin as a teacher. I'm pretty skeptical. And this is when he gets really mad at Arthur for wanting to be a squire. And so then we get our scene with the squirrels.
Oh, I hate this scene so much.
So, Dave, why don't you tell us what happens with this? Tell our listeners what happens with the squirrels.
Well, he turns into a squirrel, doesn't he? And the squirrel falls in love with him, and then he gives her the flick at the end, doesn't he?
Yeah.
watch.
It's just so weird. I mean, this is what I mean. It's just so silly. These gags that just, I feel it so off from the rest of the movie. I mean, the whole movie is silly, but this is just the silliest thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, what, you got the squirrel, poor squirrel, crying as they're walking away, you know, at the end when they turn back into a human. I bet, what kind of lesson is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's such a sad moment that makes no sense, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make any impact at all on Wart as a character.
No.
And, you know, he says that love business is a powerful thing. It's greater than gravity. It's the greatest force on earth. And that's when we hear a most befuddling thing, which is a cute song. But first of all the female characters in this movie are not the best, not the greatest. And yeah, I get it that we're dealing with animals, not mm-hmm. human beings. But nevertheless, when the only female characters that you see in your animated movie are like, these sort of, I don't know, that's not the best. And then he doesn't learn, I don't think, to care about, he's sort of irritated by her the whole time.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a moment, because it seems, I think it would have been more effective, and I mean, I hate to be prescriptive, but yeah, he doesn't learn any compassion. But I think that could be a moment where King Arthur could have learned, you know, or War could have learned some stuff about what it means to be compassionate and kind, but ugh. No, and so he just breaks her heart and they walk away.
Yeah, and she's like crying. This
and then just that horrible last shot. You know, she's in the she's looking in the tree, and then they just, you know, go back like, oh,
yeah,
so bad.
That's why I've written down the sad state of girl squirrel.
I know, it really is sad to me.
Like, I feel like they should have sort of had another male squirrel there. And then she could go off with him. And that would be cute. Yeah.
I feel like there's no weight to it. Like, even as an audience, we're not asked to feel the compassion for the squirrel. I mean, we get that last shot of her with the tear running down her face. And the next thing we're into another musical number.
Right.
With mops and stuff dancing around. It's like, it's almost like...
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on.
Huh? I mean, it's really like, these irritating females that we got to deal with. Not the best lesson for a king, I don't think.
No. Or for the movie going audience.
And so Kay and Ector fight off the dishes. They find them in there. And so Ector gets very upset. Then we also see a scene where Archibald is teaching Wart cursive. And so I kind of feel like Archibald should be king. He seems to learn the most, to be the most, the best character in the film.
He seems to be the most knowledgeable, right?
Yeah.
He's read all that stack of books that he's trying to get Wart to read, right? A giant pile of books.
Yeah. And we do find out that Merlin is a time traveler, and so he is seeing that man will fly someday, and we see that a little bit later with Bermuda. And I almost kind of, the whole Bermuda thing almost reminded me of Genie a little bit, you know, at the end, I'm off to see the world. Then we get Wart turning into a bird because he said he'd always wanted to be a bird. And he literally learns nothing in this segment at all. It's all Merlin. And he lands in Madame Mim's house. And I just think, Madame Mim, we're an hour into the movie before, and it's not that long of a movie, before we meet Madame Mim.
I feel like the film is just, there's no, like we were saying before, with Wart, there's no backstory there. And continuously throughout the film, it's just characters just appearing out of nowhere with no background. And it's almost like you have no connection to anything. The sword in the stone, the titular item of the film is in it for the first minute and then disappears again into the last 5 minutes.
For the whole film.
So I feel like again, this film is just so segmented and so episodic. There's no substance to any of the characters.
Yeah. And it's also slightly awkward if the only female character in your movie is Madam Mim, and that's it. That's really like a little awkward. And she does sing Marvelous Madam Mim, and Wart says, you know, that he can, that Merlin can defeat any wizard. And so they get in the famed wizard duel, and they set the rules before, but then they break all the rules. And it was kind of crazy in the age of COVID and the coronavirus that Merlin wins by becoming a disease. That was pretty, that rang true for me.
Yeah.
That was pretty smart, but. Yeah.
I thought about the same
thing. Yeah, what do you like about this Wizard's Duel?
It's my second favorite sequence of the film, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the story. I just think it's so clever. It's so clever. It's so fun. I think Madam Mim is an appealing character, but again, what does she have to do with anything? I mean, clearly she's Merlin's nemesis, but, you know, we don't know why. It has nothing, even though Wart kind of stumbled in on her and she's trying to take out Wart, still, there's no point to it, but I think it's awfully fun.
Yeah. I feel like out of everything in the movie, it's the one thing that just feels like a classic Disney thing.
Yes.
Where... You know, the things that I'm so drawn to in that early period of the studio is when the animators were literally allowed to just do whatever they wanted to do and just experiment with their animation and experiment with the gags and everything. And it almost feels like a throwback in this segment. The animation is incredible in this sequence, all the transformations and everything, just absolutely beautiful. And just the gags are the gags really work here. Mm-hmm. It's almost like almost like everything went into this one sequence.
Right. Yeah.
Everything.
And it's like, so true, Dave. This is this is a sequence that everybody cared about, and the rest of it is just.
It's true. It almost has the feel of like Pink Elephants on Parade in that way. Mm-hmm. Then it was like, okay, we can finally break free and be a little bit surrealist, a little bit crazy, a little bit.
Well, and I just remember as a kid, and again, it came back to me rewatching it. I loved how they kept the colors true to the characters, and as well as integrating their faces or some other part of their, you know, of their normal character design into each one of the animals that they turned into. I just thought. That was, again, such a great...
You can just feel them having fun with it.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, I mean, like, they wanted to make the Rooster film, and they got stuck doing this thing that was... Look, this film had been kicking around at the studio since 1939. Walt Disney bought the rights to the film while he was making Snow White. And it's the thing that just kept getting put off and put off and put off. All right, let's just finally make it now because... You know, we want a disposable film. And I feel like no one really cared about the movie. But this one segment just feels like, let's just go wild. Let's have a lot of fun. You really feel that.
I agree. But it's also a weird moment because after Wart says, you could have been killed, to Merlin, and he says, it was worth it if you learned something from it, which I also think is not a good lesson to teach a king.
Yeah. You know, and then what is, if I'm not mistaken, Rachel, listen to the line you're saying, knowledge and wisdom is the real power. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess you can kind of pull that out of the Wizard's Duel, but can you? was there a point? I mean, I know they had to use their knowledge to try to outsmart each other, try to outwit each other, but I didn't understand where they came up with that moral from what we had just experienced.
Yeah. Because it's actually right then that he gets upset about, he gets really grouchy about Wart becoming a squire.
Wart becoming the squire.
And he says, I thought you were going to amount to something. And I'm thinking, what is, like, the movie hasn't successfully explained why being a squire is so bad. Because, like, from all intents and purposes,
exactly,
Ward seems super excited about it. Like, why are we not why are we not supposed to be excited about it?
Ward seems very content with his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, even with, you know, I mean, I think Kay is such a jerk, but Ward's not that upset about it, is he?
No. No. He's perfectly fine.
It's not like he's like trying to get me away from the, you know, this person.
Maybe there's like a certain degree of humility that the person who doesn't want to pull the sword from the stone can is the one who can pull it. Mm-hmm. But it just feels like he is totally unprepared for what is, you know, what is going to happen.
There's just not that substance there. I don't know what they were thinking. It's just, I mean, you look at so many of these Disney movies and it's always about, you know, they start at point A and then they longing for a better life, and they go to point B. Oh, well, it's actually not any better than it was. Let's go back to point A. There's none of that in this. There's none of that full circle sort of character arc. It's, I'm happy with my life. Oh, you got to change your life. And then, oh, well, where are we at the end? You know?
Yeah, it doesn't even have, like, in the Black Cauldron, Taran, he wants to be famous, and you see him, like, he has this goal of, like, and you could say, well, that's not a very good goal, but you clearly have at least something that he's...
At least he has a goal. Something that can kind of be, you know, that shows a character arc, right? And there's some change that goes that's involved with him, but, yeah, it's weird. And then Merlin takes off.
Yeah, because he's upset, and he's gonna go to Bermuda. Then there's the wizard tournament with jousting and sword fighting, and that I thought in this sequence especially you could hear the different voices.
Of Ward.
Yeah, I think especially here. And so he forgets Kay's sword, so he takes the sword from the stone, and then. And nobody else can pull it once it's put back in. Nobody else can pull it back out. And a big crowd surround. And then later we get Merlin coming back from Bermuda. And Arthur, I guess, rules in peace and the round table and everything like that. Mm. So there you go. That is our movie.
One thing that I noticed, one final note though on that too, Rach, is that you know, when Ward pulls the sword out the second time, and you and everybody sees it, and you know Kay can't pull it out, and anyone can pull it out. I do like how they animated Kay, you know, because his dad says kneel down, you know, kneel down. He's the king, and at first Kay is just being himself, and then. They draw on his face, again, I noticed particularly this time, I think a sense of humility and acceptance. That was like a glimmer of these animation masters, you know? They're just like, I don't know who animated that particular moment, but I thought, wow, that's good. And that's, again, why we love Disney, you know, when it's really at its best. And even though this film isn't one of the best, I don't think it's still... has some elements very good. Yeah.
You do see a little bit of this movie in the parks because you have King Arthur's Carousel and you have the Sword in the Stone.
The sword, yeah.
That people can take the picture away with Merlin, who's there quite a bit. And so there's some legacy with that going on. And so where do you have this film in your ranking of your Disney classics? What about you, Stanford?
So I have it at number 46. For number 45 for me is Lilo and Stitch, and then number 47 is Make My Music. It's pretty low. There's enough about it that I think, I mean, it's not in my bottom 10, but it's definitely in my bottom 20.
Yeah. I have it at 41, so I'm pretty close. I have, and this was my last ranking that I did in 2017, so it's a little bit old. But anyway, I have Sword in the Stone at 41. I have Bolt at 40, and I have Fantasia 2000 at 42. So what about you, Dave? Do you have a ranking?
Well, yeah, actually, because I've just finished ranking the eras, what I'm planning to do next month on my channel is actually rank all of the films, all 58 films in one video.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So what I actually did literally 2 days ago was I wrote out my rankings for each of the eras and then tried to figure out the ranking of all 58 based on how I'd place them within my previous videos. So I wanted to make sure that there was no out of order, because people are just so, you know, people who watch the videos will pick up on the smallest thing. Oh, in this video, you had this film below that film. Why is it above this film? So I tried to make sure it was, you know, all done perfectly. So I'm just looking at my list here, and it's actually come a lot lower than I thought at number 52.
Yeah. It's not the best.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? I figure it at least has the Sherman Brothers songs, mm-hmm. and it has the Wizard's Duel. I think that's the two strongest parts of the movie.
For sure. I even think the Sherman's music isn't as strong in this too. And I think maybe that's got something to do with the fact that this is the first animated one they're doing, maybe. And it's really the first time they're playing around with like the tongue twisters and the alliteration stuff that they were just so excelled with Mary Poppins. I just feel like it's not like if you didn't know this was Sherman Brothers music, you wouldn't know. If someone didn't tell you that it was Sherman Brothers music, I feel like you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Dave, because I think that the songs are cute and forgettable in a lot of ways.
No, definitely. You
know, with the exception, I think Higgins Piggins, that one's pretty fun, just because I remember that one as a kid. But
again, that's the idea of using those tongue twisters, and just that typical like Sherman Brothers kind of thing. That's the only one out of the lot that's almost like, oh yeah, that feels so. But the rest of it just feels, you know, not quite as good.
Yeah.
It's no Chitty Chitty Bang Bang or Spoonful of Sugar. That's for sure.
That's for sure.
So, all right. Well, so we are actually not going to do the random number generator this time, because we are going to actually having a special guest for our next episode. We are going to have Kristen Maldonado with us, and we have been trying to have Kristen on for since March, because we were going to talk about Mulan with the live action movie, and
been a moving target thanks to COVID-19.
So we finally talked to her and we said, we'll just let you pick whichever one you want to do, because we keep getting delayed, and so she has picked Tangled, which I think is, I don't know how we didn't think to talk about it sooner in quarantine, because it's like the
it's like we're all kind of responsible right now.
It should be the theme movie for quarantine. Yeah. So anyway, she's going to be with us next time. It's going to be a lot of fun, and so look forward to that. Oh, I almost forgot. We got a ton of comments on Twitter for Sword in the Stone. Yay. So I'm just going to read a few real quick from Twitter. So we have from Matthew D. Klein. He says, "Well, not exactly one of Disney's best works, The Sword in the Stone still is a very fun fantasy film that should be given a little more attention. Thankfully, it might have more attention than some of the Disney films of the 2000s, but still." That's a low bar, but okay. Richard Southworth says, says, "I enjoyed it as a child. I was never too fond of Arthur, but Merlin was a lot of fun. The squirrel section and the wizard's duel are the best parts." So Lassie Voigt says, says, it's cute and fun. Watched it a lot as a kid. It has a nicely laid back tone and a strong atmosphere, and it's incredibly creative and funny in parts, as well as insanely likable." So there we go. Jennifer Chandler says, "I had to buy it during a rough time. I wanted to watch it with the kids. They were not interested. I watched it by myself and I enjoyed every minute of it. I need to try to show them again soon." And that's always so interesting when you watch these Disney classics with kids, because I was babysitting for some kids while their parents were packing, and I don't have anything for kids to do in my house, so we just watched Disney movies all day, and we watched Frozen. Of course, they loved that, And then we watched Jungle Book, not interested. They didn't like it at all. And then we watched a bunch of Mickey Mouse shorts, loved it. So that was interesting, I thought. Anyway, Eli Sansa says, there are moments in the film that are entertaining as standalone scenes, but as a story, the film is weak. And then Kyle Ovox says, too compromised by Roy's boys, Roy O. Disney and the businessmen who wanted to scrap animated features. And it doesn't have much of a conclusion, but the majority of it is charming, meandering misadventures with good Sherman Brothers songs and that wizard's duel. And one more. Plain Simple Tom says, it's a little baffling that the actual Sword in the Stone only appears for the last few minutes. But overall, this is a fun and underrated film. Love Merlin and Archimedes. The Wizard's Duel is excellent. And Madam Mim is wonderful and overlooked Disney character. So there we go. There you go. That's a lot of fans.
Yeah.
There on the Twitter. So and, very exciting. You know,
My reaction was probably overly dramatic when your kind reader liked you was complimenting the squirrel section. Oh dear!
It's so sad. I mean, come on.
I
but
feel
justice
like,
for the squirrel.
I feel like a lot of our love for these movies does stem from that nostalgia from it. From if you grew up with it and you loved
absolutely,
it,
absolutely right.
If you don't have that connection, it's so much easier to sit here and just either trash it or, you know, just pick it apart sort of thing. But the thing I love about the Disney films is that different people connect to different ones in different ways.
Yeah.
And these movies come into our lives at different points of time and we connect with them in very, very different ways. I think that's what's so wonderful about it all. And what I say when I do my ranking video is no two rankings are ever going to be the same. No one's ever going to share that same opinion. And there's going to be people who love the Disney movies you don't like, and there's going to be people who hate the ones that you do like, and I think that's all part of the fun of it.
Yeah, and I've watched the Disney canon 3 times now, and each time my ranking is pretty different. The top 10 doesn't change all that much, but the rest of the stuff, because I have, you know, like a whole bunch that I feel about the same on, so it's like, what do I rank? You know, you end up kind of having to nitpick, I think.
You have to get some nitpicky, yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So that'll be a fun project for you, but we'll be excited.
Yeah.
I know. I'll be excited, Dave, to see this. That's really cool.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to get it down. I try not to make these videos any longer than like 12 minutes. So I've given myself like a limit of like 45 words for each one. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
That'll be challenging.
Good for you.
Yeah, so we'll see how we go. Because I've done the big reviews on each of them in the period rankings, the era rankings. So yeah, it'll be a bit fun.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. Well, Stanford, where can people find you?
On Twitter, at Stanford Clark, and I have a movie blog and podcast at moviespastandpresent.com.
Great. And Dave, what about you?
Yeah, of course, Dave Lee Down Under on YouTube. That's like the Rescuers Down Under, but Dave Lee Down Under. And you can find me on Twitter, on Instagram, Facebook. Twitter and Instagram, my handle is just Dave Lee Down Under. And search me on Facebook, I come up as well. So I'm across the board.
Great. And you can find me at Rachel's Reviews, all of her social media, iTunes, YouTube, and on Rotten Tomatoes. So make sure to check that out. And you can find me at the Hallmarkies Podcast, where we have lots of fun content. And make sure you're following this podcast at Disney Talking on Twitter. We'd love to hear your feedback over there. We have our patron group, which is a lot of fun, and we have our merch store, so please check that all out. That'll be in the description section. And thanks so much, Dave. This was really fun. I really appreciate you make the time, especially with time differences and everything.
Thank you, Dave. I know. Around the world, it's wonderful.
I know. It's so it's mid-afternoon here, so it's okay. It's during my working day, so I had some time. No, but thanks for having me on here. It's been awesome. Had a lot of fun.
Well, yeah. Well, let's do it again.
Absolutely. Let's do it again.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you all later. Let us know your thoughts in the comments. Bye, everyone.
See you later.